Week 7, Haggai. Hebrews 12 has a singular aim, to encourage Christians to press on in becoming like Christ. We see this from the very beginning of the chapter, which opens with a kind of theme statement. Let us run with perseverance a race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. This is Hebrews 12:1-2. The chapter then goes on to develop this calling in terms of becoming a fitting heir and child of God. Christ is the true firstborn son, the one whom Christians should imitate. And so, in imitating him, Christians should become, quote, the church of the firstborn. This is from verse 23. Hebrews 12, therefore, expounds some key issues in this pursuit. The first issue surrounds the meaning of suffering. It seems the recipients of the letter were suffering, and as such, they were wondering, is this God's punishment? The author assures them it is not divine punishment, but precisely the opposite. It is, in fact, evidence of God's love for them. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as a son. This is Hebrews 12:5-6, quoting Psalm 94:12. Such suffering, therefore, is not a sign of rejection, but of adoption. God only disciplines those whom he considers his, quote, true sons and daughters. This is verses 7-11. Hebrews then goes on to contrast this positive model of sonship with a negative one, Jacob's brother Esau. This is in verses 16-17. You'll remember the story of Genesis 25, where Esau, who was the firstborn son, sold his inheritance right to his younger brother Jacob for a bit of bread and a bowl of stew. In this way, we are told, quote, Esau despised his birthright. This is Genesis 25:34. And it is this disregard for the firstborn status that Hebrews wants to spotlight. If the church of the firstborn is going to live worthily, then it needs to cherish its adoption as God's heir. And a key way of doing this is by embracing suffering as God's parental discipline. Even still, the author of Hebrews recognizes the tumultuous nature of suffering, and he seeks to provide a rock upon which the people can anchor themselves. This rock is Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. Yet it is not the earthly Mount Sinai, but the heavenly one called Mount Zion that serves as the anchor. The reason for this is because the earthly mountain was only a mirror of the true mountain, which, for now, exists in the heavenly realm. This is where the author of Hebrews quotes from the prophet Haggai. He contrasts the earthly mountain with the heavenly one, saying, At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, Once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what has been shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. This is Hebrews 12:26-27, quoting Haggai 2:7. What the author is saying, therefore, is that the first mountain of God, Mount Sinai, represents the elements of God's kingdom that are passing away. But the second mountain, Mount Zion, represents the things that will remain. The most important difference is that Mount Zion is the bedrock of a strong and lasting kingdom, quote, a kingdom that cannot be shaken, Hebrews 12:28. The use of Haggai here is interesting, for from a modern perspective, it is difficult to discern why Hebrews quotes this text. In short, Hebrews' use of the text seems unrelated to its original meaning in Haggai. The book of Haggai itself is a collection of oracles delivered by the prophet in the post-exilic era, probably around 520 BC, when Israel had returned from exile. His oracles especially concern the temple, which had been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. While the people had begun returning to the land and living in furnished houses, the house of the Lord, that is the temple, still lay in ruin. Haggai found this deplorable, and he prophesied that the Lord wanted the people to rebuild the temple. But how does this relate to the message of Hebrews? The key lies in mental maps of ancient Israelites in the early church, that is, in the way they imagined reality. In the ancient mind, a temple was the center of a kingdom, the place in which the divine dwelled, providing blessing and protection to the whole of the land. But the temple itself was not God's true house or home. It was only a model of his true house, which existed in the heavenly realm. That is why God's house was erected on a mountain in Jerusalem. Symbolically, it touched the realm of heaven. And that is why, when the biblical writers wanted to reference the enduring reality that lay behind the earthly kingdom, they called Jerusalem Mount Zion. For even when the temple was destroyed or the kingdom fell, God's true dwelling and kingdom remain unaffected. And that is what Hebrews is drawing upon here. It encourages believers to stay true to their calling in spite of suffering, reminding them that their hope is not the temple or earthly kingdoms, but God's true dwelling and kingdom in heaven. Unlike earthly temples and kingdoms, God's is unshakable. Hebrews 12:26-29, again quoting Haggai 2:7, 21-22. At the end of all things, his kingdom will again descend upon earth. But for now, Christians are called to anchor their hope in the heavenly kingdom. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for God is a consuming fire. This is Hebrews 12:28-29, quoting Deuteronomy 4:24. When the author of Hebrews quotes the prophet Haggai, therefore, he is drawing upon Israel's ancient mental maps.